Blog Talk Radio.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
Welcome, friends, brothers and sisters in Jesus Christ, and speakers of the truth. But whoever you are, I know that we all share one thing in common. Don't we all want to know the truth? The truth about what's really going on here in this crazy, crazy world. So welcome. Welcome to the 591st edition of SDG, Sola Dea Gloria. And the title of this message today is 2023 Endgame Update Number 7. And a bit later in this message, folks, stay tuned because we're going to tie it all into the antidote to fear and torment. And who can't have fear in this crazy and chaotic world? Well, the Bible says in John, actually the first letter of John, chapter 4, verse 18, that there is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out all fear, because fear hath torment. He that feareth is not made perfect in love. So stay tuned to learn what perfect love is and how to have it, and what happens when we don't have perfect love. The bottom line, folks, is that as believers, we may be in this world, but we're not of this world. We're just God's people. And what are we doing, folks? We're just passing through. So remember to stay tuned to find out the latest news that the mainstream media will never tell you as we dive deeper and deeper into America's new 9/11 events, which are unfolding in slow motion while on steroids. But remember, folks, it all started with this lab-engineered, media-manipulated coronavirus heist. And as we do every week, folks, let's get started with something from a past episode. Now, just last week, we talked about the 16-year-old high school student in Canada who was suspended for what? For holding fast to the truth. The truth that God created two genders, male and female. Well, he's not the only level-headed teen who's being harassed and troubled by the establishment for doing nothing more than embracing traditional American values grounded in the truth. Now, this next clip we're going to listen to came from our friend and dear brother, Alex, out at his school district in Ohio. And get this, folks, this Johnson Community School District, and that's where Alex teaches. This school district had the audacity to actually have one of their students arrested. I'm not making this up. And for what? For wearing a T-shirt to school on September 1st. That had a Second Amendment quote on it and a picture of a gun. Now, this came 2 days after a discussion in government class about free speech where their arrogant and over-the-top teacher said that I define free speech in my classroom. So the following day or 2 days later, the student, who's unnamed because she's a minor, we know she's a girl, but that's all we know, she was actually arrested for having that shirt on and expelled from school. So let's hear the report from CBS affiliate KCCI 8 in Des Moines, Iowa. Thank you, Brother Alex.
Suspended over a T-shirt. A Johnson High School student says that's what happened. So she is now suing the district. KCCI's Marcus McIntosh is live in Johnson tonight. And Marcus, this case may remind some people of the Tinker versus Des Moines case from 1965.
How true that is, Steve. In the Tinker case, the First Amendment issue surrounded students wearing black armbands to class in protest of the Vietnam War. Here at Johnston High School behind me, it's over a single student who wore a T-shirt with a Second Amendment slogan and a picture of a rifle. It's a situation where the student may have been testing her government teacher. It's a test the student's lawyer says the teacher failed.
This is the T-shirt in question, with a Second Amendment quote and a picture of a rifle. A T-shirt that does not have the students we spoke to up in arms.
My opinion about it isn't anything bad.
No, I mean, it's just a shirt. It'd be a different story if it was an actual gun, but, like, it's just a shirt. I don't find it offensive at all.
It was worn by the student who was a minor and unnamed in Thomas Griffin's government class September 1st. According to the court filing, it was 2 days after the students had a free speech discussion in Griffin's class, when he told students their free speech was extremely limited on school property and the teacher decides what is acceptable in the classroom, and he would not allow students to wear clothing that depicts guns. The student believed Griffin was wrong about the First Amendment, wore the T-shirt, and was told it violated the school's dress code, was sent to the office, and eventually suspended. The student said she had a right to wear the T-shirt, a T-shirt she has worn to school in the past. Her attorney is Alan Ostergren.
There was nothing about the shirt that was threatening to anybody, and really this teacher overreacted.
Ostergren says Griffin, who is active with the Bill of Rights Institute and an adjunct instructor at William Penn University and Nebraska Methodist College, is not upholding the First Amendment.
He violated it by punishing this student for wearing something that quoted the Constitution. It's not right. It's illegal, and that's why we're in federal court.
Students say they understand pushing the boundaries and testing limits, adding this T-shirt does not come close to either.
There's, like, way worse T-shirts out there.
We reached out to the Johnston Community School District and received this statement that reads, "The Johnston Community School District has not yet been served with notice of this complaint and has no comment at this time." We're live in Johnston. I'm Marcus McIntosh, KCCI 8 News, Iowa's news leader.
Again, thank you, Brother Alex. That was an excellent example of how far we've fallen. Oh, and by the way, folks, the student in Canada, he's in the news again. This week, he was arrested for going back to class. Can you believe this? Remember when the the officers that used to look for kids skipping out of class would arrest you for not being in class? Well, enough said on that. What do you expect in clown world?
You worry about leaving a better planet for our kids. How about leaving better kids for our planet? Entire generation offended at everything, getting mad that a human thinks all lives matter. We don't need black or white or left or right. What we need is common sense. We need balance. We're all in the same boat. Why are you trying to make holes? If they stink, we stink. This is madness. I'm offended that you're offended by me taking offense. Can't build a wall. Why does your house have a fence? I believe in two genders. I'm not mad at the rest. I'm just confused when a dude has a beard and some breasts. We won't always agree. Nope. I don't hate all beliefs. Nope. I don't think that the system's racist. I just think the system hates peace. Oh, I think fighting violence with more violence is what they want. Viruses and riots, people dying, we won't stay home. Black lives matter, all lives matter. What's all this division for? It's modern segregation. This is setting up a civil war. Burn the circus down, cause the world is full of clowns. They're all stupid and they're proud, painted smiles on their mouths. I don't hang with bozos, homie, I can't be around you. Anyone who knows me knows my feet don't fit in clown shoes. When I was a child, the only races that we hated were the ones that we ran and didn't win. Then we stopped playing with each other, started hating on each other, started noticing the color of our skin. Christians and atheists, immigrants, patriots, we love the country, but we are not saving it. Wages don't raise to the rate of inflation, and half of the country hates all of the nation. It's funny that we think the world owes us something. All the phones got smart, but the people so dumb. We care more about the likes on a selfie than our moms, and the only time we ever speak the truth when we're drunk. We won't always agree. Nope, I don't hate all police. Nope, your thoughts and opinions ain't facts, and they are not defining my reality. Nope, I think picking sides divides is probably what has got us here. United States is great regardless. That's what we've forgotten here. Black lives matter, all lives matter. What's all this division for? It's modern segregation. This is setting up a civil war. Burn the circus down, cause the world is full of clowns. They're all stupid and they're proud, painted smiles on their mouths. I don't hang with bozos, homie, I can't be around you. Anyone who knows me knows my feet don't fit in clown shoes. They tell you be yourself and then they judge you on the internet till everybody hates you for it. If Jesus was alive, I swear to God that y'all would cancel him, cause lately being negative is the real new normal. Yeah, if you're thick, you're fat, you're rich, you're bad, you're poor, you're black, you're white, you're whack, they lie, it's facts.
My generation needs a bunch of free condoms. Common sense ain't that common. This is what they wanted. This is how they planned it. This is to control everyone on the planet. Then we put each other in caskets, protest and panic. And they take advantage to manage the damage. We won't always agree. No, freedom doesn't come free. No, there was people fighting, dying overseas. So that you could have freedom and be home. I think the elites are real, but they ain't drinking baby's blood. They're creating chaos, so they have something to save you from. Black lives matter, all lives matter. What's all this division for? It's modern segregation. This is setting up a civil war.
Burn the circus down, cause the world is full of clowns. They're all stupid and they're proud, painted smiles on their mouths. I don't hang with bozos, homie, I can't be around you. Anyone who knows me knows my feet don't fit in clown shoes.
Thank you, Tom McDonald. Now, folks, if you haven't listened to any of his music, I'm not into rap music, but this man is a truth teller using a medium, or I should say a genre within the medium of music that I don't even listen to. But I'll tell you what, I listen to this guy all day long. But like I said, enough said. What do you expect in clown world? And right now, we have to keep moving. It's time for our Freaky Deaky News update from Sister Kathy and Brother Alex. And as we do every week, folks, let's get started with our coronavirus heist update. And that's what it is, folks. It's a bunch of lies and mind control, and that's so sad. Now, as we've been doing every week here for the last several months, let's get started with our sudden adult death syndrome update. Now, this is a tragic story of a 17-year-old football player who dies suddenly in his sleep following, once again, a cardiac arrest. You can't make this stuff up, folks. Now, this is a rather alarming and very disturbing global trend that's involving young people dying suddenly and unexpectedly. And it's continuing, folks. Just last week in Quebec, Canada, at Laval High School, an otherwise healthy 17-year-old football player named William Caron Cabrera died suddenly following a cardiac arrest. Now, the cause of the cardiac arrest, the sudden death from this heart event in a 17-year-old, is unknown right now. And they say that a full autopsy has not yet been performed. Now, the sad thing here, folks, is that no healthy 17-year-old even needed to get the jab. Their immune systems would have brushed off COVID like a cold very quickly. We know that from the data. And we also know the cause. Let's be honest here. We know the reason. And at this point, we ought to be expecting many more of these deaths to come. And I'm not looking forward to this. I'm not excited over this. I'm saddened by it, folks. But it's the reality that I've been warning about since early 2020. And the sad thing, at this point, there's no way to stop the aftermath or the consequence of these choices that people made. This, folks, has become the new normal. How important our decisions and beliefs truly are. Now, there's another one out of about the 12 that I read of this week alone. In fact, soon it's going to get to the point where we just give a head count, a body count, I should say. But this next story is a 34-year-old Border Patrol agent who dies suddenly, again, due to a sudden heart attack. This was Border Patrol agent Jesse Mercado. He died suddenly on Saturday due to an unexpected and sudden heart attack at just 34 years of age. And this was put out by his representative, Myra Flores, of the 34th District in Texas, on a social media post. Now, it's sad, folks, but remember, Border Patrol agents and all the trainees were required, mandated by the federal government to get jabbed or face restrictions or possible termination. 79% of all Border Patrol personnel were fully vaccinated as of November 2021. Rest in peace, Agent Mercado. This is sad. And just in, folks, the autopsy will be conducted in a month or so, and we'll get back to you with the results. Tongue in cheek there, folks. You know we'll never hear word of it again. I'm telling you the truth here, people, and why? Well, do you honestly think the establishment's going to disclose the enormous blood clots they discovered during his autopsy? No, we've covered that ad nauseum here on this show. And then there's all these paid shills out there from the celebrities pushing the jab. Remember Elton John and who else was in there? So many actors and comedians and musicians. But did you hear this one from the newest corporate water boy and paid shill? None other than John Legend himself. Well, recently, good old Johnny Legend, and don't even get me started on him and his perverted wife, Johnny is pushing the boosters for none other than Pfizer. Listen to this. Paige Schill, John Legend, lie and push these boosters that are killing people.
Okay, I know I'm talking to every parent out there. Life with little kids can be a juggling act. Luna's got dance. Miles has basketball, plus they both have school and their own personalities. And now we've got a little baby in the house. But I wouldn't trade being a dad for anything in the world. I love being there for my special moments with my kids. That's why my health is such a priority to me and why I got an updated COVID-19 booster. My family did too. I encourage you to talk to your healthcare provider and go to vaccines.gov. to check eligibility and schedule an appointment today.
What a shill for the establishment. Now, let me give you the backstory on this. So this was posted on Pfizer's Twitter account, and they have the replies disabled. So get these stats here, folks. There were only 72 likes, 37 retweets, yet there were 1,118 quoted retweets. Now, this is a page that has over 500,000 followers, and this particular post had over 154,000 views. Hey, Pfizer. Hey, John Legend. You think there's a message out there for you? Well, the message is nobody's believing your lies anymore. And did you hear that the Pfizer CEO, Albert Bourla, who we've covered on this show, hasn't been getting boosted? And your lies, John, they're egregious, especially those concerning you and your wife and everything you spew about not being into pedophilia? Well, if that's the truth, Johnny, then why did she have to delete over 60,000 social media posts that indicated otherwise? And I have some of them archived. Your wife is a sicko, and now I put you right in that same class for what you're promoting, John. Damar Hamlin, if that's who he is, refusing to disclose the official reason the doctors gave him for his heart stopping, an otherwise healthy 24-year-old, listen to him, refusing to disclose the official reason for his heart stopping. In this interview, I think it was on CBS, but don't quote me.
From the ICU, the question on so many minds, what caused his heart to stop beating?
You're 24, peak physical condition, could run circles around me right now. How did doctors describe what happened to you?
Listen to this pause.
That's something I want to stay away from.
I know from my experience at the NFL, they do more tests than anything. And in the course of you having your physical, did anybody ever come back with any, say you had a heart issue or anything that was abnormal?
Honestly, no. I've always been a healthy, young, fit, energetic, human being, let alone mm-hmm. athlete. So it was something that was just, that we still processing, and I'm still talking through with my doctors just to see what everything was.
That's something I want to stay away from. That's all Hamlin had to say. That alone, folks, tells me all I need to know about this. It was the shot. and he's probably being threatened. Not about it. You know, don't say anything if you ever want to even have the slightest chance of playing football again. Keep your mouth shut or else we're going to defund you on all your charities. You're going to be a washed-up loser. Folks, if he was truly a Christian, and there are people out there saying, well, he's doing this because he wants to save lives. Well, then come out and say what caused you to die on that football field on Monday Night Football where tens of millions, over 100, what was it, 150 million people saw that? Whatever it was. If he's truly a Christian, he'd speak the truth plainly and point to the guilt here. And the guilt is Pfizer and all the other pharmaceuticals pushing these non-vaccinations as vaccinations, which are neither effective or safe. Plus, did you see the jacket he wore at the Super Bowl mocking Jesus? He's not a Christian, folks. Maybe a Christian in name only. But there was a tweet out there by Adrian Peterson blasting Damar Hamlin's blasphemy jacket seen on the Super Bowl. He said, and I'm going to quote him from his tweet, in an act of overt mockery, Damar Hamlin is wearing a jacket that says eternal in rainbow-colored letters and has a satanic skull-faced Jesus being crucified on what appears to be a blast. He's in a loincloth holding a handgun. Now, what's that all about? That's not Christian, folks. So when are our elected officials going to stop being afraid to tackle this ginormous elephant in the middle of the room? Everyone knows, and we know that they know, and they're just afraid what will happen to them and their careers and their money if they speak up and stand on the rock of truth. Now, according to this so-called expert that we're going to listen to next, this sort of behavior must stop, and you're going to hear why in this next clip. But before I play, let me give you the backstory on this. Now, there was a study from Cedars-Sinai's hospital, and that was supposedly or is supposedly a respectable hospital. And I'm going to go over the stats with you. They claim that in the year before the pandemic, there were 143,787 heart attack deaths. Within the first year of the pandemic, that number increased by 14%. 164,096 deaths. The excess in acute myocardial infarction-associated mortality has persisted throughout the pandemic. Now, they're counting pre- and post-vaccination as all part of the pandemic. You know, this thing's going on, according to the Biden regime, up until May. So they say that even during the most recent period marked by a surge of the less virulent Omicron variant. So what they're saying is we're baffled here. Heart-related deaths are increasing in the youngest age groups, ranging from 25 to 44. And now in the second year of the pandemic, that's post-vaccination, the deaths are up twice what they were pre-vaccination. So the bottom line here is that they need to put a stop to this sort of lying rhetoric in what you're about to hear in this next clip. So I'm not denying that data there, but listen to how it's spun by CBS News medical contributor, Dr. Celine Gounder, who says that the deaths are up in young people because they're not getting their jabs and they're not being masked. Listen to this lying rhetoric.
Heart attack deaths have become more common across all age groups since the start of the coronavirus pandemic.
But a recent study found that young people are actually most at risk in this case. According to Cedars-Sinai Hospital, the number of heart attack deaths among 25 to 44-year-olds in the U.S. over the first 2 years of the pandemic was 30% higher than predicted. Dr. Celine Gounder is here.
Sorry about that, folks. Stood off. Let's restart it.
Heart attack deaths have become more common across all age groups since the start of the coronavirus pandemic.
But a recent study found that young people are actually most at risk in this case. According to Cedars-Sinai Hospital, the number of heart attack deaths among 25 to 44-year-olds in the U.S. over the first 2 years of the pandemic was 30% higher than predicted. Dr. Celine Gounder is here on set with us to talk more about it. She's editor-at-large for public health at Kaiser Health News, and she is also an infectious disease specialist and epidemiologist and a CBS News medical contributor. Dr. Gounder, thank you for being here. What stood out to you in this study?
I think the fact that you're seeing such a big increase specifically in the youngest age group, so the 25 to 44-year-olds, you saw this 30% increase in the risk of death from heart attack. And that really is quite striking. That's not a group, an age group, in which you normally see heart attacks, much less dying from a heart attack.
So to do a study like this, you look at the years prior to the pandemic and the typical rate of heart attack death in that age group, and then you see it increase, and you wonder, what's the new variable? And so the pandemic is that new variable?
That's right. So these researchers looked at 10 years of data across the U.S., all the death certificates that get filed with the CDC, that data. And so what they saw is prior to the pandemic, heart attack deaths were actually dropping. And then that trend reverses, and you see those deaths go up, especially among that youngest age group during the pandemic.
And just, do we know why younger people might be more at risk? Or
we don't know for sure. And in fact, these death certificates are probably not even capturing the fact that they might have had COVID. They're really just saying, did you die from a heart attack or not? What we do know, however, is that younger people were less likely to protect themselves against COVID than older people, less likely to mask, less likely to take other mitigation measures, and they were also farther back in line to get vaccinated. So they were not protected with vaccination until later in the pandemic. Those might have been a factor here.
So basically, I mean, you could have had perhaps a mild infection, and of course this is all hypothetical, but then there might have been a lingering heart situation, heart disease.
Right. So COVID causes inflammation of the blood vessels as well as other parts of the body and also blood clots. And what we think is that a COVID infection may have actually accelerated the process of developing heart disease, what we call coronary artery disease, and so therefore accelerated when somebody might have had a heart attack and died from a heart attack.
You know, but COVID also changes how much you can get out to an exercise class, how often you see friends, maybe your level of activity overall, your stress, whether you see your doctor.
I mean,
how are they ruling out or accounting for these other lifestyle changes?
We don't know. So you can't really assess that just from looking at death certificates. Again, all we can say is, how old were they? Did they die from a heart attack? But, you know, some of the factors you're mentioning could certainly have played a role. We also know healthcare facilities were really overwhelmed during the pandemic. So was it that somebody had a heart attack and then was less likely to survive because the healthcare facility was overwhelmed?
Couldn't get there on time. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much. Something new to go and see your doctor and check yourself about. Thank you.
Thank you.
Folks, did you hear the perfidy in that interview? So the mainstream news is now reporting a 30% increase in heart attacks. They can't deny it anymore. We cover these sad updates every week. And they have to acknowledge that this is happening in young adults. Yet the cause is the real issue here. They're saying, or this fraud is saying, that lower rates of masking and vaccinations in young people are the cause. I'm telling you, these people are sociopaths. And can you see how much they're lying to protect Big Pharma and the establishment? Now, according to a study conducted by the University of California, teenage boys are six times more likely to suffer heart conditions after being jabbed with these mRNA technologies. Six times more likely to suffer a heart attack than being hospitalized from infection due to coronavirus. Now, from January to June of last year, a team led by this doctor named Tracy Hoag investigated the rate of heart inflammation and chest pain in children aging in ranges from 12 to 17. That's following their second jab, okay? And what her team discovered was that boys in the age range of 12 to 15 were the most at risk for suffering adverse cardiac events. And they found that boys in this range, there were, 12 to 15 complications. I'm sorry, there were 162 complications per million boys jabbed. And this was the highest out of all age groups. So that garbage that she fed CBS News team, that you really can't correlate this, That's a bald-faced lie. And then they found that boys aged 16 to 17 averaged 94 per million, and girls followed behind that with about 13 per million. Folks, these statistics are a very strange thing. And a very wise man, an economist named Aaron Levenstein, once said back in 1951 that statistics are like a bikini bathing suit. What they reveal is suggestive, but what they conceal is vital. Now, just like a bikini, these stats that everybody spouts can be used to both reveal much while hiding the vital. In this case, the vital is the fact that the jab's what's causing the deaths. Stop and think about it, folks. There's no decline in vaccinations. Once you took it, you took it. So what Dr. Celine Grounder is saying, you know, the paid shill for Pfizer, and the lies that we just heard on CBS referring to the lack of people who are willing to get boosted. Remember, she's still talking about people who had two previous jabs. So before the booster became the nom de jour, so to speak, we were talking about shots. But now it's all about boosters. You see how they spun it? Give the impression that it's the unvaccinated who are dropping like flies. Remember when you were still technically unvaccinated for 2 weeks after your jab? So now they're not referring to vaccinated, they're referring to boosted. And if you aren't boosted, you're classified as unvaccinated. So that is just the way that they spin the truth to fit their agenda. And it reminds me how they used to call deaths occurring within 2 weeks after the vaccination COVID deaths because you weren't yet fully immunized. Do you remember all that, folks? Yeah, Alvin, really. But those dropping dead had been jabbed. Remember the nurse that took it on national television and she collapsed right there on live TV and now nobody can find a trace of her? People are dropping dead after they are jabbed. And this whole immunity argument has nothing to do with it. Nothing, folks. It's simple cause and effect. Get jabbed, increase your likelihood of dying. Think about it, folks. But I'm looking at the clock, and we have to keep moving, and it's time for our Kabuki Theater update.
COVID-19, George Floyd, Rice, BLM, police report, the 2020 election. All merely coincidence? I hardly think so. Folks, it's called Kabuki Theater. In Japanese, ka means salt, bu means dance. Ki means steal from the verb, kabu meaning to slant or display. Folks, it's all a lie. It's the flattened curve. The curve of the economy, stupid, must slow down the velocity of money. Portal hyperinflate before we're done. Stealing it all, Trump, bad. Must go, good is bad, bad is good. Up is down, light is dark. It's all Kabuki Theater, folks. Prepping the masses for agenda 2030 and the new world. Just say no to it all and wake up before it's too late.
And speak about lies and distraction. These balloon stories are nothing more than distraction. And a bit more on that later in the show. You know, the real issues are being ignored today by the fake news. And I'm just going to name a few for you. We've got the Hunter Biden laptop scandal. Investigations now underway on that. Along with the election fraud that's now proven in Arizona. And did you hear that the appeals court just denied Harry Lake's appeal? It certainly wasn't done on evidence, folks. I haven't gotten into those details, but it sounds to me like it's another procedural type thing. She's taken it to the Supreme Court of Arizona, and if need be, to the Supreme Court of the United States. And we will see the level of corruption based on the rulings from these various courts. And then don't even get me started on what we just covered, the alarming bears data for the COVID jabs. And then how about this Russian-Ukraine crisis? Absurd. And now the bombshell evidence from Pulitzer Prize winning journalist Seymour Hersh, I think his name is, exposing the truth now that Joe Biden and his regime and the Norwegian intelligence community were the ones behind the Nord Stream pipeline explosion in the Baltic Sea back in 2022. And now Russia's pushing on this, and they're getting nothing but crickets out of the UN. Now, it's tragic, folks, but most tragic incident right now that's being ignored for the most part is this predictively programmed dioxin release out in Ohio. Now, out of all the commentary I've looked at this week on this egregious act of democide, Jesse Waters over at Fox probably did the most comprehensive. Not necessarily on the details of the actual event, but the BS being fed to we the people by the government and their lapdogs, mainstream media. Now, the best details are actually in this piece coming from Millie Weaver, you know, the former InfoWars reporter who got arrested after she put the expose out on the Pillars of Power or whatever it was. Now, we're going to cover more on Millie's report a bit later in the show in the Back to the Future session. But right now, I think the most comprehensive commentary out there is from Jesse Waters, and I'd like to play it. It's a long clip, but stay with me here, folks, because he covers every base.
After a 50-car train full of toxic chemicals flew off the rails last week, the government has the video of the train derailing, but won't release it. The skies over East Palestine were filled with 50 tons of toxic chemicals, a toxic mushroom cloud, chemicals like vinyl chloride. It's now in the clouds causing acid rain. The community says it's like someone dropped a toxic nuke on them.
We basically nuked a town with chemicals so we could get a railroad open. I was kind of surprised that when they quickly told the people they can go back home. There's a lot of what-ifs, and we're going to be looking at this thing 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the line and wondering, gee, cancer clusters could pop up, you know, well water could go bad.
But the state government's top doc came out today and said those cancer clusters are no big deal. You've been exposed to these things your whole life. If you get cancer, it's not because East Palestine looks like Chernobyl.
Most of the chemicals that we're worried about and that we're talking about fall into a category known as volatile organic chemicals. Volatile organic compounds, or VOCs, it's important for us to recognize, are actually a part of our everyday life. So if you go this afternoon on your way home to pump gas in your car, you're being exposed to volatile organic compounds.
So Ohio Fauci says, don't mind the cloud of black smoke over your city. Breathe it in. It's organic. The same government who forced us to wear masks outside for 2 years now says chemical explosions in your neighborhood are just a part of everyday life. Now get back to work. We weren't allowed to go to work for 2 years because of a virus that gave 99% of us a runny nose. But you better punch in at 9 a.m., Ohio. Even if it means inhaling mustard gas on the way in. Everything's fine. Just don't look in the rivers. The fish aren't dead. They're just sleeping at the surface.
Another fish. There's hundreds of them up here. Another fish. Another fish. They're just everywhere. Fish. Fish. Fish.
Totally normal. I mean, who wouldn't drink from a stream chock full of dead fish? Because that's the stream where the community's drinking water is from. They shower with that water. They wash their hands with that water. And the government's just telling them maybe buy some Poland Spring. Who cares about a couple of fish anyway? Ohio's Parks and Recs lady says it's not like anything with fur and feathers are dying, you know, nothing like warm-blooded, fuzzy little creatures or anything.
We don't have any evidence of non-aquatic species suffering from the derailment. Haven't had any concerns about that, not only here, but we also communicate with the Pennsylvania Game Commission as well, and they haven't heard about that either.
Well, except the chickens that are dropping dead.
Amanda Brashears was going to feed her five hens and rooster this morning when she discovered them all lifeless. She believes the smell following the detonation of the train carrying chemicals that derailed in East Palestine is to blame for her birds' sudden death.
My chickens were perfectly fine before they started this burn, and as soon as they started the burn, my chickens slowed down and they died.
I guess Biden's got his new excuse for egg prices going up. And it's not just fish and chickens. It looks like foxes are next.
Taylor tells me all of his foxes have been sick and acting different since the weekend.
Some have abnormally puffy faces, including the one he's holding. He says they are not eating properly. Many are dealing with stomach issues and are acting lethargic. Taylor says the train derailment is causing all of these issues.
I don't know about you, but if I go to the zoo and every animal's dead or acting strange, I'm turning around. Aren't we just a bunch of animals anyway? I mean, at least the men are. We had a guest on last night, a resident there, who says symptoms are already hitting them. Listen.
As far as the smell, that's definitely present. I came today where we are right now at my shop. This is the first time I've been here in a week. And I was here 5 minutes and I had a headache. I have a headache right now. And you can't spend a lot of time here without feeling like crap. And my question is why, if it's okay, if it's safe, and all these people say it's safe, if it's so safe and okay, then why does it hurt?
But the government doctors in Ohio say, you know, probably the same ones who locked us down for COVID, say, oh, you're getting headaches? It's probably stress.
People around East Palestine suffering headaches, other health problems like sore throat, et cetera. And then in addition, other anecdotal reports about animals dying like chickens and cats.
Unfortunately, volatile organic compounds share with a host of other things the ability to cause very common symptoms at the lower levels. So headache, eye irritation, nose irritation. We have to look at the measured facts. And the measured facts include the fact that the air sampling in that area really is not pointing toward an air source for this.
So poison gas is lighting up the neighborhood, and government doctors are saying, you know, your runny nose, your headache, probably just the common cold. Wait a second, a year ago, you couldn't go to the gym unless you were double vaxxed with a mask. If you coughed, you had to isolate for 10 days. So what's going on here? Are we looking at a cancer cluster and the doctors are telling us to shake it off? We need a second opinion. Remember 9/11, all those first responders rushing out into the ash all over their face? We are still paying claims for that. People died. And where the hell is the president? Biden never shuts up about trains. And he told us he was going to cure cancer. And now a train goes off the tracks. They light it on fire. It's probably going to give everybody cancer. And the president calls a lid. You have the whole Ohio River contaminated. These chemicals are flowing downstream to West Virginia. And we haven't declared a national emergency. We declared a national emergency over monkeypox. And there's no national emergency here. Biden was too scared of letting a single piece of debris from a balloon fall in Montana. But he's okay with cancerous chemicals in our rivers. And if not Joe, you'd think maybe Al Gore would be mad. No. Chemical catastrophe causing acid rain, dead fish. How is Al not red in the face right now? Even Mayor Pete's in hiding. And he's literally in charge of the railroad system. This thing's so bad, even Ilhan Omar and Jesse Waters' primetime agree. The squadster saying, quote, we need direct action from Pete. But there's a major cover-up happening. The rail company, Norfolk Southern, they're doing whatever they want. When Norfolk Southern's train spilled 500 tons of toxic chemicals all over Ohio, they said, all right, guys, this is how we're going to handle things. You know this crime scene we have here? We're just going to light it on fire. And the Biden administration and the Ohio government said, okay, just throw a match on it and we'll say it's safe. So why'd they let the careless rail company light the crime scene on fire? Well, Norfolk Southern, they donated to pretty much every politician, especially in Ohio. Think of any race you can, even the primary, from state, local races, all the way up to the Senate. They just poured money into everything. Republicans, Democrats, doesn't matter. This company, the last three administrations, lobbied to kill brake regulations. These guys are in charge. So where's the EPA? If they say my plastic straw is destroying this country, then they must be all over a cancer-causing gas bomb in the Ohio River Valley, right? Or the random toxic ash that's raining down in Illinois. Well, actually, the EPA administrator, Michael Reagan, no relation to Ron, is too zoned in on electric school buses to care about poison drinking water. He just announced a pledge to support electric school buses nationwide You have cancer? Here's an electric bus. Does this guy, Reagan, even know anything about the environment? Well, we looked into him, and the only reason he was nominated to run the EPA was because he promised to fight off environmental racism. Is this his idea of fighting environmental racism, spilling toxic chemicals on poor white people in Ohio? He doesn't have time to worry about a cloud bomb of toxic fumes over Ohio. Just like the EPA didn't have the time to fix the Animas River, remember, after they spilled toxic sewage into it? Remember?
500 gallons per minute is the rate the Environmental Protection Agency says mustard yellow metal contaminated wastewater is flowing into the Animas River in southwestern Colorado. The EPA's own workers triggered the spill last Wednesday when a crew investigating the Gold King mine breached a debris dam. At last estimate, more than 3 million gallons of water containing toxic mining chemicals like cadmium, copper, manganese, and zinc has discharged into the river. Weekend sampling found high levels of arsenic and lead as well.
So Obama's EPA refused to pay for any of that. They said they wanted to pay, but the law didn't say they had to pay. Yeah, so about those $1.2 billion in damages, we can't get involved, even though we may or may not have caused it. The EPA didn't care about that river, just like they don't care about East Palestine. And they don't really care about safety. Primetime just found a report that four whistleblowers inside the EPA claim officials are covering up cancer-causing chemicals. Whistleblowers are saying that they've been tampering with tests on chemicals to make them look less toxic, so they can ride them on the rails with the bad brakes and make more money for Norfolk Southern. You think the EPA is serious about cleaning this up? They're covering it up. Tell you what's happening there is normal. Just a runny nose, just a cough, just a headache. Deal with it.
Now, like I said, folks, this is the best commentary I heard out there, but there are some flaws in it. For example, When he asks rhetorically, why no accountability for the railroad by the government? And he said, well, it's because of political donations. Well, no, folks, it's even deeper than that. And stay tuned to the Back to the Future episode. And I'm going to connect the dots that nobody else has on this and show you that the reason is that these railroads that operate in this country were founded by the Illuminati. Now, I know it sounds stupid, but just stay with me, and you'll see what I'm talking about. Now, have you noticed that the so-called climate change alarmists and all the environmentalists are totally silent? We're hearing nothing from them on this. Where's Greta or Al Gore or all the other normal gang of outraged woke people coming to their agenda? And it's looking more and more like foreign actors are involved. You know, the FBI is actually investigating all of these issues right now. I think there's five in the past week. And you know, all of this points to one thing. And it proves to me that the folks like Al Gore and Greta, they don't really care about the environment, the water, or air quality. Their focus is made up, make-believe. Just like this BS environmental racism from the new director, Reagan. Seriously, folks, it's all kabuki theater. Just like the destruction of the food processing plants and our food infrastructure, it was intended to destroy, this event was intended to destroy fertile land and water managed by those out there, people like you and me who are self-sufficient. They're trying to force people to become reliant upon the government for all of their needs. And here's why I say this, all of this stuff is conspired. There's developing news now out of both South Carolina, Texas, Michigan, and Arizona that there are additional spills. And like I said, they're being investigated by the FBI. No, notice these are all in swing states, red-leaning areas. Plus, we can even tie it into good old lesser magic, folks. Yeah, lesser magic, specifically predictive programming. And Greg Reese over at the Reese Report did an excellent clip on this. So let's just listen to what Greg Reese had to say about all of this.
In the movie Knowing, the news reported a major oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico.
Tonight in the Gulf of Mexico, an explosion on a soon-to-be decommissioned oil rig triggered a fire which burned for 3 hours before it was extinguished. Officials don't yet know the exact cause of the explosion, but believe a malfunction in the cooling system may have been at fault. Due to the prompt response of the rescue unit, the structure was evacuated with no loss of life.
A year later, the Deepwater Horizon exploded. 6 months before 9/11, a Lone Gunman episode showed us the World Trade Center being targeted by a hijacked passenger plane.
Corner of Liberty in Washington. Lower Manhattan.
World Trade Center. We're going to crash the plane into the World Trade Center.
And last year's film, White Noise, was about a train wreck that poisons a small town in Ohio. This is the very same story now playing out in real life. Within a year of White Noise's release, the actual event occurs in real life, in Ohio, in Texas, and in Michigan. This is known as predictive programming, and its purpose is to psychologically trick the minds of the masses into accepting major traumatic events that would otherwise be resisted. In the book Secret Societies and Psychological Warfare, Michael Hoffman describes a mind control technique known as the revelation of the method. And he writes that when the revelation of the method is performed in a veiled manner, accompanied by certain occult signs and symbolic words, and elicits no meaningful response of opposition or resistance from the target, it is one of the most efficacious techniques of psychological warfare and mind rape. Sarah Elkhaldy of the Alchemist YouTube channel does an excellent job of explaining all this. According to Elkhaldy, there is a law of nature in this universe that compels the dark occult to first gain our consent before trespassing against us, because they believe this protects them from the natural laws of cause and effect. They offered, and we accepted, so it's all fair. A lack of response to an action is often taken as an approval of that action. And there is an old Latin proverb that says, he who is silent when he ought to have spoken and was able to, is taken to agree. Silence is considered by many to be a form of consent. And so it is through a veiled performance of the revelation of the method technique that these dark occultists believe they are gaining our consent, what we know as predictive programming. With predictive programming, the minds of the masses are impregnated with visuals of a major event before it happens. This is done through all forms of media and can be very subtle so that nobody notices. But the subconscious mind notices everything and can easily be programmed through repetition. And so these controllers repeat whatever it is that they want us to accept as reality. Because these images are delivered to us through entertainment, they elicit no meaningful response of opposition or resistance. And so we accept them subconsciously. And when the event happens in real life, it is already familiar and acceptable to us, as if that's just the way it is. It's a mind trick, and it works by keeping everyone locked in a spectator state. This causes what is known as paradigm blindness, which is when a person is incapable of seeing any reality other than what they've already been exposed to by the media. This paradigm blindness will cause a person to get emotionally triggered whenever confronted with an alternative point of view that they have not been programmed to accept. It's a very powerful mind trick, and the solution is quite simple. We need to stop living as spectators of someone else's reality. We need to start creating our own reality. And we need to remember how to say no, because they offer it to us and we accept it. Reporting for InfoWars, this is Greg Reese.
Folks, I thought Greg did an excellent job there. Now, he's covering a lot of things that we've covered for over a decade here on the SDG show. Secret societies. We've covered all that, folks, and we continue to do. And like I keep saying, this is all kabuki theater, all of it, from 9/11 to the Trump presidency. It's all showbiz, folks. Think about all that's been revealed in The Simpsons over the past 20 years. But do you really think it's only the demonic left who's in on this kabuki theater? Come on, folks. Trump's just an actor, a pawn in this pandemic narrative. Think about it. Operation Warp Speed. And sure, he's saying all the right things, but then he surrounds himself with a bunch of World Economic Forum insiders. He's marching us just at a different rate to the Great Reset, folks. And up next in this whole kabuki theater is the fake nuclear war. The U.S. government is going to help stage and plan a Chinese invasion. I really do. If not, something even more crazy, like a UFO invasion. Think about this for a minute. Just let a true patriot stand up and try to run for president. Let somebody stand up and in his platform talk about declaring war on the globalists and the World Economic Forum and just see how quickly he gets JFK'd, or as some people say, Kennedy'd. Now, I pray for anyone with the guts to expose DARPA and all the government psyops and crimes against humanity. And don't even get me started on the SWAT teams and all the snatch-and-grab globalist goon forces with their private militias known as police. Here's an idea. Let's shut down the elections to everybody but the landowners and taxpayers. Sounds really radical, but the notion of one man, one vote is a Marxist concept and not sustainable in any healthy republic. You know, the landowners and the businessmen were the ones that had the most to lose, so would choose most wisely. And people are going to say, oh, they oppressed the poor. Well, how are the poor doing today, folks, under this one man, one vote? Give me a break, okay? Think about it. You know, it's only a brutal, honest, driven, transparent patriot with guts enough to do all this that's going to turn this nation around, not Donald Trump. I'm telling you, this nation is done. Now, what do you hear from most of the alt media? Well, they're out there telling you to get your popcorn and enjoy the show. So you know what I say when I hear that? Hooray for Hollywood.
Hooray for Hollywood. That's gooey, bally, hooly Hollywood, where any office boy or young mechanic can be a panic with just a good-looking pan.
And any shop girl can be a top girl if she pleases a tired businessman.
Hooray for Hollywood!
Now, you've probably all heard that song years ago, but Hollywood is actually an arm of the Illuminati. And the wood of the holly was the rod, the material that Merlin, the magician, made his staff out of, or his rod. The wood of a holly. Now, on the brighter side, people are waking up on both sides of the political spectrum. Did you hear this latest from comedian Tom Green? Not to be confused with the other Canadian comic, Red Green, who was one of my personal favorites. He used to have a show on PBS years ago, folks, every Saturday night. I think it was 9 to 10 o'clock on WQED, Channel 13, Pittsburgh. Terry and I used to watch Red Green. But no, this is another Canadian comic, Tom Green. And listen to what he has on all of this kabuki theater.
Hi, I'm Tom Green. And forgot to mention, the other reason this UFO information is coming out now is because they're trying to distract us all from the fact that we're about to get released the Epstein Island list, as well as what's going on in Palestine, Ohio, with the train derailment and the chemical release of chemicals into the air, which is being called possibly as bad as Chernobyl, and the fact that World War III might be about to start in the Ukraine
war between USA, Russia, and China. So that's what's going on. Good to see you guys. Hope you guys are having a great day. There's UFOs.
So bottom line, there seems like a lot of red pilling going on out there these days amongst these well-known liberals. Think about it. First, we had Steve Kirsch, who's now on fire on Substack, trying to expose the lies of the big pharma. You got Russell Brand. How about Tim Robbins? Now there's Bill Maurer. And now Tom Green. Who's next? Maybe we're going to hear the commie Rob Reiner himself out there giving speeches on the evils of progressive ideology and identity politics. Who knows? I don't. But I'm telling you what, people are waking up. We have to keep moving, and now it's time for our newest segment where we prove that for the love of money is the root of all evil. And we call this Follow the Yellow Brick Road.
Follow the Yellow Brick Road. Follow the Yellow Brick Road. Follow the Yellow Brick Road. Follow the Yellow Brick Road.
Follow the Yellow Brick Road.
Follow the Yellow Brick Road. Follow the Yellow Brick Road. Follow the Yellow Brick Road.
Now, folks, have any of you ever heard of the Business Cycle Dating Committee? And no, it's not some new app out there for your smartphone. It's not. You know, there is a new app out there now for the unvaccinated, a new dating app, but this is not a dating app. The Business Cycle Dating Committee is a little-known committee that determines and defines the start and end of recessions. Now, we've heard a lot of people lately on the news saying, well, no one indicator can tell us if the U.S. is in a recession. But, you know, folks, for decades, I used to hear that it was after you had, what was it, two or three quarters of economic decline. That was technically a recession. But now we're being told that it's a group of people known as the Business Cycle Dating Committee that makes the official call. Now, here's an establishment look from the normally reasonable Wall Street Journal explaining how this group determines when an economy has entered into a recession. Let's have a listen.
The economy is in a confusing place right now, and there's a lot of speculation around this one word.
The latest sign that we may be headed for a recession.
Are we actually in a recession?
I do not think the U.S. is currently in a recession.
So what actually determines when the U.S. enters a recession? It's not this, or this, or this. No one chart determines a recession. Rather, it's these eight people, a group known as the Business Cycle Dating Committee. Here's how this group decides when the U.S. is in a recession and why knowing that date is so important.
It matters if you're going to lose your job. It matters if your income is going down. It matters to business if they're going to be selling fewer cars or fewer televisions. So our entire economy is oriented towards producing more. And a recession is when everything goes wrong and we go in the other direction.
Knowing when a recession starts and ends is important because it can inform how we respond to these downturns later. This group of economists is selected by the NBER, or National Bureau of Economic Research. Each member on the committee is an expert in, well, business cycle dating. Business cycles are patterns of peaks or high points and troughs, low points in economic activity. That period between a peak and a trough is a recession. The NBER has been dating business cycles back to at least the 1920s, but formalized the committee in 1978. The committee is nonpartisan, and its makeup doesn't follow set guidelines. The number of people on it can vary, and some have been there since its inception. It's included people like former Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke.
Thank you.
What they try to do is seek balance and really even-handed data-only approach to just looking at the data and what they show and put the politics out of it.
The committee doesn't meet regularly, only when economic data looks like it might be reaching a peak or trough. So what are the data they're actually looking at? The NBER officially defines a recession as a decline in economic activity that's spread across the economy and lasts more than a few months. To track that economic activity, the committee looks at several indicators: income, employment, real sales, personal consumption expenditures, or the value of stuff bought by people in the U.S., and industrial production.
What they try to do is they try to look at broad indicators that measure all of the economy at once.
Across these categories, they're looking for three things. Depth, which is how far indicators are declining. Diffusion, which is how far the decline has spread across the economy. And duration, which is how long those declines last. If each shows deep declines lasting a long time, that would mark a clear start to a recession. Just take a look at 2007, when all of these categories saw a significant drop after December. But it's not always so clear-cut.
The economy is this dynamic organism, and it doesn't always behave according to the textbooks or the conventions about how we think it should behave.
The time that each indicator peaks can vary widely. This chart shows how many months before or after a recession start date that some of these reached a peak. For example, in 1980, sales started to decline 10 months ahead of the committee's economic peak. Or look at 2020, when the committee called a recession at the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, even though the downturn had only lasted 2 months. James Viterba, the president of the NBER, explained the reasoning on CNBC when the start of the recession was initially declared.
The depth of this downturn is such that the committee felt comfortable labeling that as a recession.
Yeah, the thing with these economists is they want to be scientific, but there's some art to this too. There's some kind of just like feeling around a problem and just saying, we got to make our best call.
This method of calling a recession isn't standard. Many analysts and commentators across the globe look at GDP, or gross domestic product, for guidance on when a recession has started. GDP is a measure of how much goods and services a nation produces. The common rule of thumb is that any time it declines in two consecutive quarters, that indicates a recession. You can see that was the case in 1990. But again, this data alone isn't enough, because
the challenge with that is that how much stuff we produce as an economy doesn't tell the whole story. It only tells part of the story.
If you look at 2022, GDP did drop in these two quarters, but employment, a key indicator for the committee, was still strong. So the NBER didn't call it a recession. At least, it hasn't yet. That's because the committee usually doesn't call a recession for months down the line. Just look at the start of the 2008 recession, which the committee didn't make an official announcement about for a year.
The fact of the matter is a lot of these data that they're looking at are revised months or years down the road. And so when they make these declarations, they want to be on firm ground. They don't want to be revising the dates that they put out there as often as the data are revised. So they tend to act with a little bit of a lag.
So when the committee does make a call, it doesn't often have that much effect on the current economic situation. Still, knowing the precise time a recession has started is important politically.
When someone is running for president or re-election, people make judgments about whether that person has done a good job in office. And so we look at whether there was a recession.
And it's also important economically.
By having that sharpened view, they could kind of do some analysis of, well, what were interest rates doing around then? What was inflation doing? What were jobs doing? So by sharpening your view of the past, the hope is you can make better judgments about the present.
Though the committee hasn't yet determined if the U.S. has entered a recession, economists in a WSJ survey think we're likely headed into one this year.
During and after the COVID shock, there's just been a lot of turbulence in this economy. And so we have indicators going up and down in different and divergent directions that make it very hard to read how the economy is behaving right now.
And since the committee is backward-looking, there isn't a clear timeline on when or if an announcement could come.
Now, that was a lot of double talk, wasn't it? Did you hear that line in there? They want to be scientific, but there's a lot of art here. Well, folks, I don't know about you, but I don't want any art concerning my bank ledger. I don't want any art concerning my finances. I want zeros and ones and all the integers in between. I want them, folks. I want specificity. I want 1 + 1 = 2.
I want 10 minus 9 is 1. I want math, pure and simple. And then CNN comes out with this drivel on this business cycle dating committee. Right after the Wall Street Journal, CNN comes out and asks, who decides if the U.S. is in a recession? 8 economists you've never heard of, CNN Business. And then they go on and they have the nerve to write, and this is crazy, Janet Yellen, America's first woman Treasury Secretary and its first woman Fed Chair, has argued that the lack of women and minority economists at the Federal Reserve and the federal government is a top priority. And then they get into the whole diversity mantra, you know? She says, the lack of diversity skews viewpoints and limits issues of discussion. Increased scrutiny and discussion about representation is focused on the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, on which Lisa Cook became the first black woman to serve last month. Folks, what does one's color or gender have to do with their ability to serve on a board that should be based on numbers and science? And then they go on to say that this committee, which is a private institution, yet receives government funding, has largely avoided criticism concerning their lack of diversity. You know, this all sounds like that ESG drivel. And it reminds me of what J.D. Rucker wrote this week on one of his Substack articles. He said the end goal of DEI is LGBTQIA plus supremacy. Now, if you wonder what DEI is, it stands for diversity, equity, and inclusion. It's an agenda that's used race and sex issues to build its power base. But the shift is now underway to bring their ultimate goal to the forefront. And what's their ultimate goal? What's the ultimate goal of diversity, equity, and inclusion? Well, the push for the last decade was all about race and gender. And we saw the surge leading up to the death of George Floyd and how they played that whole narrative. And then the whole Black Lives Matter mantra, you know? And now it's shifted focus to the LGBTQ agenda. But really, that's not the bottom line here, and that's not the purpose of all this. The diversity, equality, and inclusion agenda has a demonic push behind it. And it's a push to indoctrinate and normalize perversion. They're going after our children now. Did you hear what happened in Spain? Spain has just passed a law that it's legal for minors to have abortions and not disclose their sex change process to their parents. Now, JD links this diversity, equity, and inclusion agenda to a deep dive article titled Sudden Dominance of the Diversity Industrial Complex by Thomas Hackett. And this was published over at Real Clear Investigations. And folks, I'm telling you, go out there and check it out. DEI is all about destroying good for evil and emptiness, taking abundance and making nothing supposedly desirable. You own nothing and be happy. Destroy family for self-centered, hedonistic individuals hell-bent on blaming whites and traditional families, even though most of them themselves are white and came from traditional families. That's what this is all about. They are products of the Sabbatean Frankfurt perfected government. I mean, public indoctrination. I mean public schools. Folks, it's all so disgusting. When I hear the word equity, I equate it with losers. Equality is real and worthy, whereas equity, that's a falsehood, folks. Oh, and by the way, did you notice that this all sounds a lot like what we covered last month on the Sabbatina philosophy of redemption by sin? Just saying, folks. And it's really curious to me. There's a whole lot of smart pastors out there, but I don't hear many of them talking about any of this. And how's that thing go that Hosea said in chapter 4, verse 6? My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. But we have to keep moving, and now it's time for Coop Talk with Henrietta. Hey, Henrietta. Hey, what happened to winter around here, Henrietta? We didn't really have a winter. It was 65 degrees here on Wednesday. Now it's a little chilly out there today, huh, Henrietta? But nothing like a normal winter. What I'd like to talk about today, folks, is water filtration in light of the disaster unfolding in Ohio. And if you look at the plume, it moves up through northwestern Pennsylvania up into New York. And it looks like it's going to hit New York City. Now, a byproduct of burning nearly 1 million pounds of vinyl chloride, one of the byproducts, in addition to acid rain that everybody's talking about and some of the other chemicals, is dioxins. Now, dioxins are a group of toxic chemicals
that share certain common chemical features. And I'm not going to get into all that. But more importantly, they all elicit similar biological effects. Now, there's several hundred of these chemicals out in publications. And what I've noticed over the past 3 or 4 months is that all the government websites are changing the way they define dioxin toxicity. And this is sickening, because here's a few known facts that we've got over four decades of data on. Dioxins are what are known as persistent organic pollutants. And by that, it means it takes a long time to break them down once they're released into the environment. So they're very persistent, and they're highly toxic, and they can cause cancer, reproductive and developmental problems, damage to your immune system, and they even interfere with hormones. And they're found all through the world in most every environment. And what's so tragic about them is they accumulate in the food chain, concentrating through the fatty tissue of animals. So if there's a cow out grazing in the field and you like your nice, fat, greasy hamburger, you're probably eating dioxins if the field the cow grazed in was polluted with dioxins. And more than 90% of typical human exposure, estimated by the old EPA data, was through the intake of animal fats, mainly meat, dairy products, fish, and shellfish. Boy, you think this fits into their agenda? You know, eat bugs and be happy. And like I said, the government data websites on this, so the ones at the EPA and the CDC and those sorts of things, and I think over at OSHA, they have been revised over the past couple of months. And then here we have this disaster. Now, the first line of defense to protect yourself against any kind of dioxin exposure is a good water filter. Now, Berkey filters claim to work, and that's good for drinking water. But I'm referring to whole house. You don't even want to have exposure on your skin through shower and laundry, because the skin, your skin is your largest organ, and it's very absorptive. And you don't want to bring these things in. So I'm talking about a whole house water system here. I'm researching this right now. And it looks like it's going to be a series of filters, including an activated carbon filter followed by some water softening and then reverse osmosis, or RO as it's known. And then you better keep your water tested, and you better keep up on the maintenance of your system. Now, I'll provide more details in the future about this situation. Right now, I'm researching it, and I'm reviewing some lab data posted by the Ohio EPA. This was lab work performed right down the road from where I live, in a town called Greensburg, Pennsylvania, in a lab known as Pace Analytical. Now, email me at kdbeer1961 if you'd like a PDF copy of this latest lab report. But I'm going through it, and it's literally hundreds of pages. But we have to keep moving, folks. And right now, I want to get into our hopium report.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Hopium Report, where dreamers of all sorts come for their faith snort. Prepare to get high on hopium.
Now, with all of this governmental malfeasance and the corruption, all the way down to outright criminality with the elections, creating a new 51st state out in the heartland of California. Have you heard about that? These are good and decent people who live in California. And, you know, outside of a couple of the perversion centers known as cities, used to be called Sodom and Gomorrah, now they're called San Francisco and Los Angeles. Outside of those areas, those concentrations of perversion, most of the people out in the heartland of California are good and decent people. Most of them voted for patriots, yet they had their votes stolen. So the latest right now, in this article from the Gateway Pundit, is titled Moving Onward, the State of New California Sends Delegates to Washington, D.C. So the story goes like this. There's the new state of California moving forward. And just this week, they sent two delegates to Washington, D.C. to represent the 51st state. And supposedly, they're going to be meeting with Speaker of the House, McCarthy, that rhino. So they refer to this as another historic day in the new California. State of California is gearing up for statehood. The new state of California is gearing up for statehood. And it goes on to say, this may seem strange until you understand that they're following constitutional precedent. Well, yes and no. And then they go on to argue that it's following the model of the state of West Virginia formed during the Civil War. And then they say, well, the state of California is following that same model. So let's listen to an interview recently conducted by the American thought leaders with the founder of the new California state movement, Paul Preston. It's a 2-minute and 15-second
What exactly is the new California movement, and what are the grievances it's trying to address?
And how does this highlight the urban and rural divide among voters in California? Are there precedents for forming a new state out of a pre-existing one? And how is the new California movement relying on the U.S. Constitution to achieve this?
This is American Thought Leaders, and I'm Yanya Kellick.
Today we sit down with Paul Preston, founder and president of the Movement for a New California State. We discuss how realistic the new California movement actually is, why God would be reintroduced into the preamble of the new state constitution, and how the Reynolds v. Sims 1964 Supreme Court decision undermined the U.S. lowercase r Republican model of governance, leading to the challenges facing many Californians today.
Paul Preston, wonderful to have you on American Thought Leaders.
Thank you for having me.
So, Paul, you're the founder and president of the Movement for a New California State, and this might sound kind of outrageous to many of our viewers.
Right.
Can you tell me what this is all about?
Well, we're actually forming a new state from California. We're in the process of forming a new state from a pre-existing state and following the Constitution. Our Constitution and Declaration of Independence and Bill of Rights provides for us to form a new state when the citizens feel compelled to. And so right now, with there's obviously a lot of things going on in California and have been going on in California. There's great unrest with Californians. And we've managed to pull it together over the course of last several years, probably 8 years, to actually get a cohesive state movement together. And there's been a number of other programs. You've probably heard about six-state, three-state, that sort of thing. None of them were constitutional. They didn't pass constitutional muster. And our state movement has passed constitutional muster. We've seen all of our opposition fall off, basically, with their attempts at forming new states because they weren't following the Constitution. So we've adhered to the Constitution, and we're in the process of forming the 51st state.
Now, some say that this new California movement and Paul Preston are frauds. Reporting on it, news sites like the Gateway Pundit and others are all suckers. Suckers for saying that something like this, the stupid plan, as they call it, is even viable for anything other than making leftist-controlled hellholes. But, you know, the real crux of the criticism is that that whole thing with West Virginia happened during the Civil War when the state they seceded from was a rebel state, as the government called it. So everybody was in agreement in Congress that we should allow this state to be formed. But do you really think the people in Congress, because you have to have the support of Congress, both the House and Senate, and you have to have your state legislature in support of this. Do you think that's going to happen, folks? So they say Preston only started this venture after he felt a hostile takeover of what was known as the State of Jefferson movement. They said that West Virginia did not follow the Constitution, and neither did it set the example. So more kabuki theater. They claim that states are properly formed, new states are properly formed under Article 4, Section 3. But if you get into that, it can't be part of an existing state. So let's look at the State of Jefferson movement just a bit. It was revitalized back in 1941, just prior to the attack by Japan on Pearl Harbor. It was a dream that the residents of Northern California and Southern Oregon shared. They wanted to secede from California and Oregon and create a new state. And this whole movement started back in 1852 with a bill introduced to the California State Legislature. And the bill died in committee and was never acted upon again. After Oregon became a state in 1859, the miners in the area refused allegiance to either state government and declined to pay taxes. Then along came the Civil War, and settlers increased, and this was a haven there for northern slavery. but unfortunately this move also failed. It was laying dead for quite a while, and then in 1941, it was resurrected. And these residents decided they weren't being fairly treated by their state governments. Now, this region was mostly timber, fishing, and farming, and other things like cannabis that's been there for a long time. And they didn't have a very good infrastructure supported by their state governments. So they had poor road quality, they lacked bridges, and it was very difficult for them to move around, both in terms of employment and then to get their produce to market. So they wanted to break away from their states. And they started to gain all sorts of momentum, and this looked like it was really going to take off and happen. Then along came December 7th, 1941, the day that lives in infamy, the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor by Japan and the beginning of World War II. And this dream for the 49th state died. Remember, the 50th state was Hawaii, and that happened later. So they were thwarted by World War II and then periodically revived since 1941. But still, a lot of people talk about it today. And many of the businesses carry the name of Jefferson in Northern California and Southern Oregon. In fact, you see signs all over there, that area that says the state of Jefferson. Maybe that's why you have the Emerald Triangle up there and all that, what do you want to call it, rebellious spirit that made the marijuana movement? I don't know. I'm just saying. And the state of Jefferson's official money is the $2 bill. And why? Because it has Thomas Jefferson on it. Now, this all relates to a theme of revolution, reaction, and reform. And that's because it's very similar to the last revolution back in 1776. And that all happens because there's this feeling of isolation from the government and lack of representation. That's when people decide to do these things. And that's why I think you have these movements. And that's why I have them in Hopium, folks, because honestly, do you really think any of this is going to happen? Now, if you want to learn more about this, you can go out to jeffersonoutfitters.com, and they have a whole history page on it. But this new state of California and the state of Jefferson, they're not unique. Have you heard of the State of Superior movement? That was the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and the Northern Tier of Wisconsin. Same situation there, folks. Hospitals in Lansing, Michigan, and Madison, Wisconsin were ignoring the needs of the people up there and robbing them of their wealth through natural resources. Plus, there was a similar movement a long time ago in the panhandle of Florida. And don't forget about the Five Flags of Texas. So Godspeed to the state of Jefferson and the New California movement. But in my humble opinion, folks, these are merely hopium. Let's keep moving, and it's time for the Absurdian Report.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the world of the absurd. This is the Absurdium Report.
Life mimics theater. But fiction is safer. The curtain rises. The show begins.
Like I said earlier in the show, folks, these balloon stories are absurd. They're distraction, just like the UFO narrative that Tom Green talked about. They're to distract us from things that are more important, like the Epstein Island list that was due to be released this week, the Norfolk Southern governmental fiasco over in Ohio. How about the Nord Stream pipeline bombshell story? And we talked about the Hunter Biden laptop investigation. Oh, and by the way, the GOP's re-looking into the J6 investigation. And don't even get me started on the collapse of the dollar, folks. And then this week, White House National Security Council leader, I think John Kirby, says the Pentagon has no idea what objects they shot down and still no recovery of any debris. Have a listen to this lunacy.
Joining us now, National Security Council Coordinator for Strategic Communications at the White House, retired Rear Admiral John Kirby. Very good to have you on the show this morning. Does the White House, are government officials ready to tell us what these objects were? They've got to have an idea.
Thanks, Mika. Appreciate having me on here. We are going to continue to share as much information with the American people as we can as we learn more about these objects. The truth is that we haven't been able to gain access to the three that were shot down Friday, Saturday, and yesterday, in large part because of the weather conditions. And the third one yesterday was shot down over Lake Huron, so it's underwater. So we're going to do everything we can to recover them. And as soon as we do that, we'll learn more about them, and we will absolutely share what we can learn with the American people.
So Admiral, is there a possibility that these objects could be could they be commercial in nature? Could it be, from a tech company that you've got Google Earth and you've got other people that want to map out the entire Earth? Is that a possibility that you all are considering?
Absolutely, Joe. I mean, there could be completely benign and totally explainable reasons for why these objects are flying around up there. Certainly don't have to be nefarious at all. There are corporate entities that operate these kinds of things. There are academic research institutions that do this sort of thing. We just don't know. But as soon as we can find out, we can get the debris and we can find out, we'll absolutely share what we can.
Oh, wow, folks. Did you hear all of that? Think about it. The Biden administration gets caught allowing a Chinese spy balloon can gather intelligence. And they didn't shoot it down till its mission was complete. And then, lo and behold, strange objects begin to appear all over the country, and they don't know what they are. Now they have the ability to shoot them down over the country. They just can't explain what they are, what kind of propulsion systems they use, or even what they are. And they let people fill in the gaps. But you can't rule out aliens. And by allowing people to fill in the gaps, you create distraction. Now think about it. Let's think rationally. If this was a UFO from light years away, from an advanced civilization, do you really think an F-16 could shoot down a warp speed starship from light years away? Come on, think about it. That's absurd. So we have aliens traveling light years from their home planet, if even such a thing exists. Yeah, they're easily shot out of our sky by an F-16. So here's my conclusion, folks. This is all a psyop meant for distraction, but it's a nice try, deep state. The people aren't buying it. Paul, just in. The White House's John Kirby says that Chinese spy balloons are operating during the Trump administration, but Trump's team wasn't able to detect it. But good old Joe Biden and his de facto regime were able to go back into history through their time window and determine all this. Isn't that convenient? Stop and think about it. And then this absurdity comes out from none other than Chuckie Schumer, explaining away why they didn't take out the Chinese balloon instantly. Listen to this dribble.
The first balloon, there was a much different rationale, which I think was the appropriate rationale. We got enormous intelligence information from surveilling the balloon as it went over the United States.
Didn't the Chinese get enormous intelligence as well?
Well, they could have been getting it anyway, but we have to know what they're doing, okay? And we don't know exactly, but we got a lot of that.
Enough said on that, folks. We have to keep moving, and now it's time for Ken's Corner, spelled with a K.
Welcome to Ken's Corner, spelled with a K, where I'll share my life experiences to help you understand what's going on in this crazy, crazy world. So let's get started.
Now, earlier in the show, folks, I let out a little teaser that I'm going to go further than Jesse Waters concerning this whole railroad fiasco over in Palestine, Ohio. Now, he said that the reason the railroad's getting off scot-free is because they have bought off all the politicians on both sides of the aisle, Republican and Democrat alike. Well, I say, It's even deeper than that. The railroads in the United States were founded by the Illuminati. So I'm hearing all this railroad stuff this week, and something was nagging me. It's like, didn't you have a book like that, Ken? And then I think it was Wednesday morning, I woke up, and it's like, Pandora's Box, that's the one. Written by Alex Christopher. So I got that book back in the 90s, folks, and it was an eye-opener for me. So what I did is I put 11 labs together, and I'm using an AI voice named Sam today. Where are you, Sam? And I'd like to play a clip from Sam, if I can find it here, folks. Come on, Sam, where are you? No, Sam. There it is. So this is 11 Labs, and I'm obligated when I use their service to let you know that this voice was synthesized through their technology. I'm using their voice, Sam, to read you a Perceptions Magazine review of Pandora's Box back from the 1990s. Now, remember when this was written, and listen to some of the stuff said here.
Perceptions Magazine review of Pandora's Box. This is the review that was done by Perceptions Magazine. Once I started reading Pandora's Box, I could not put it down. It is a saga that begins with the earliest concepts of European-American history and makes its way up to the present, to include the Committee of 300. Author Alex Christopher projects into the future and gives explicit descriptions complete with drawings of the gray men described in alien UFO abduction stories. In short, this is the strangest, most compelling and disconcerting historical dissertation I have ever read. Disregarding the premise that winners get to write history, Christopher writes history from the loser's point of view. My mind reeled with disbelief, but I was compelled to accept this new awareness because it came from too many diversified and disparate sources for it to be dismissed. This profoundly disturbing material is supported through facts, logic, and well-argued concepts. Bloodlines are traced through history to the Knights Templar, who perfected a monetary system in the 13th century that was to become the foundation of modern gold-backed banking systems. Later, when these Templars were driven from their homes, they used their mastery of the sea to begin the great voyages of discovery. It appears to be no coincidence that Christopher Columbus's flagship bore Templar crosses on its sails. The goals of the one-world government are revealed in Pandora's Box: the abolition of ordered government, of private property, inheritance, religion, patriotism, and family. Who would benefit from such disruption? The English crown, operating through the Virginia Company, a commercial corporation owned by the King of England since 1604. This company acquired a piece of land on the Potomac River for its private use and changed its name to the United States of America. Additional background history and heavy documentation explains why today more than half the land and all the power and transportation companies in the U.S. are owned by the railroads. It also explains why we have become dependent on the rest of the world for our food, why we are part of a plan to depopulate the earth. Pandora's Box identifies a positive, immensely irresistible source of private power available to any being who has the mind to recognize and understand it. If you've got a brain in working order and can afford this book, get it. You may experience a conceptual birth and epiphany, a revelation, but once you do, forget about living in blissful, trusting ignorance forevermore.
Folks, that review was written in the 1990s. They mentioned the railroad. They mentioned population reduction and attacks on food supply. Now, my good friend, or I should say my friend, we've lost touch with each other, but my friend John Cerucci, the guy my former podcasting partner John Seitzinger blasted on Blog Talk Radio and the Trib Now show that we founded back in 2016, he blasted John Cerucci on air for advocating gun ownership for self-defense and family defense. By the way, a belief I support, folks. But John Cerucci posted a copy of Pandora's Box over at archive.org, and you can check it out. And there was a reviewer there, LA Blog 546, who bashed the book. I'll cover more on that next week. But he actually turns around what the Reese Report talked about with regard to Michael Hoffman's revelation of a method, and he basically argues against it. It's just the way these trolls work, folks. But I'll get into that next week. Right now, We have to keep moving, and it's time for our Back to the Future episode. It's the segment where we take something from the past and bring it back to the future. So let's wind the clock back in this episode or this segment of Back to the Future. Let's wind it all the way back to the 5th century AD. And remember, folks, I promised to show you the link between the railroads of the United States and the Luciferians, also known as the Illuminati. So we have to wind it all the way back to the 5th century AD. And to the Merovingians of what's known today as France. Now, a little bit of history on the Merovingian dynasty. These were the ruling family of the Franks from the middle 5th century to 751 AD. And they're also called the King of the Franks. And I think Ryan Reeves, a historian out on YouTube, did a very good job on introducing the whole concept of the Merovingians. So let's listen to what Ryan Reeves had to say in an intro, a short intro, about a five-minute clip to his half-an-hour teaching on the Merovingians. Have a listen.
But in this lecture, we're going to look at the Merovingian and the Frankish Empire, because the Merovingian and the Frankish dynasty is perhaps the most important factor in shaping the new medieval world of the West. The Merovingians go back to a Frankish past that is first documented, we find, in the 2nd century. There are all kinds of groups that live just north of the Roman boundary, the Roman limits. And, of course, the Romans would refer to almost all of these people just generically as the barbarians. But one of the subsets of the barbarians were the Frankish tribes. And there were a number of different Frankish groups. But shortly after the 3rd century, we see the rise of a group called the Salian Franks. And they were predominantly in the Rhine Delta. And these Salian Franks end up becoming the first group, the first barbaric tribe, to come down into the Roman territories and establish themselves as somewhat partners, not fully, but somewhat partners with the Roman establishment. We see some, of course, maintain their own identity, and they refuse to adopt any Roman practices. Others in the Salian Frankish groups, however, were more than willing to partner and to commingle themselves with the Roman ethos. And so these Frankish groups, the Salian Franks for one and a number of others that we can't go into, and a number of other northern barbaric tribes end up forming the backbone of what we would today call the Germanic culture of northern Europe. And it needs to be stressed at this point that the Franks are not simply proto-Frenchmen. The Franks themselves are actually the forefathers of all kinds of later European cultures. They are, in fact, essentially Germanic, we would say. They have an impact on future French culture, which is, of course, why Napoleon and other Frenchmen would look back to Merovich and others as part of their past. But the Franks would equally shape Germanic culture, Dutch culture, and a number of others. And this is because the areas above the old Roman boundary lines share a common past. They share a Germanic past. And so when we come to the Franks, what we find is not some distinct culture necessarily, but rather a common Germanic culture that is expressed and cultivated within the Frankish world. And out of that world, as the Roman Empire falls, we find the rise of a group that calls themselves the Merovingians. Now, the Merovingians over the centuries have been known as the long-haired kings. And this is due to the fact that all of the images and all of the descriptions we have of the Merovingian kings shows them with at least hair down to their shoulders, if not sometimes even longer. And this is due to the fact that the Merovingian kings, being pagan, believed that their hair, the length of it, was somehow the key to their success and to their military might on the battlefield. And no, this doesn't seem to have arisen by some engagement with Sansom or biblical stories of long hair. This seems to have come about as a result of some sort of pagan belief in the length of their hair as serving as some kind of talisman that gives them strength. They didn't leave their hair long for the sake of ritual purity. They left their hair long because they believed it gave them some strength that others did not have. Now, the other factor of the Merovingians is that they were pagan. They had resisted the Arian expansion in the early centuries, 4th century in particular, when there was a spread of the Arian faith amongst certain Germanic tribes of the north, in particular groups like the Visigoths. And the main missionary to spread the Arian faith around other barbaric tribes is Bishop Ulfilas. Ulfilas had been baptized by Eusebius of Caesarea, who was himself an Arian, at least a modified Arian in some ways. And Ulfilas had taken the Arian faith to the north. He had taken it to the Germanic tribes. And it was Ulfilas who had concocted the Gothic alphabet and had translated the Bible into Old Gothic, which then led to a further expansion and spread of the Arian faith. The Merovingians and the Franks, however, were pagan. They were not Arians. And so Merovich, even though he was difficult to understand historically, given all the legends that surrounds him, and his son Childeric were rank-and-file pagans. They were polygamists. They espoused all kinds of ritualistic worship of various gods. Now, these gods, later by Gregory of Tours, would be wrapped up in Roman gods, and he takes Germanic gods and gives them the names Mercury and Jupiter and these kinds of things. But they seem to worship their own kind of gods. And these gods and these deities had all kinds of strange ritualistic practices, certain amounts of sacrifice. In some cases, certain artifacts and talismans were used by these pagans as symbols of power and strength, just like the Scandinavians or the Vikings. The Franks and the Merovingians often would base their village or their tribe around a sacred oak or a sacred tree. And so the Merovingians and the Franks have very little to do with the expansion of the Christian faith, be it Arian or be it Catholic. That is, of course, until Merovich's grandson Clovis I comes to the throne.
Okay, that's a good place to stop there. That's a very good thing on the Merovingians, and I recommend this great video by Ryan Reeves. In 30 minutes, you're going to get to the essence of all this, and I just want to highlight a few of those. First of all, this whole concept of Arianism, it's flawed, borders on heresy, because the Arians claimed that Jesus was God, but not co-eternal with the Father, but rather created by the Father in eternity past. And that's blasphemy. So let's start filling in some of the blanks from what I've learned over 30 years ago, after reading Alex Christopher's Pandora's Box. So you heard him mention the oak trees. Well, if you go to any of the wealthy homes that you can tour up in Providence, Rhode Island, the Vanderbilt Estate, you'll see acorns and oak trees. And earlier in the clip that I edited on Ryan Reeves, he talks about the bees or the cicadas that Napoleon picked up from the Merovingians. And then Ryan mentions all these strange practices with sacrifices. Think about spirit cooking with that freak Brockovich, I think her name was. And think about all the movers and shakers that participated in her spirit cooking. So to understand what we refer to as the Illuminati, you first have to understand that this group is the ultimate keeper of what I'll refer to as Gnostic knowledge. They're the ones at the top of the hierarchy, okay, who purposely hoard knowledge to themselves in order to exercise power and control and dominion over all others. When the power of love overcomes the love of power, we'll have peace. But these people don't want peace. So this Gnostic religion, also known as the Babylonian mystery religion, and yes, it goes back that far, folks. You can call them the cabal. You can call them the Luciferians or the deep state. Call them whatever you want, okay? In this discourse today, we're going to refer to them as the Illuminati. Now, Springmeyer, and this is a guy that we interviewed or talked about on Tribulation Now, had this illustration referred to as Springmeyer's pie. It was in a book he wrote, and I'm looking for the quote or the reference, and I can't – oh. Be wise as serpents.
Now, I'd like to just talk about this image, and it's up on the banner page for this podcast if you want to look at it. Just picture a pie, and before you cut slices into the pie, cut three concentric circles. Now, in the middle circle, you have the key men, and they're all Satanists and worship Lucifer. And I think the Council of Nine actually meet with Lucifer, who appears. Then outside in the next portion of the wedge, you have the cover or the ruling body. And then outside of that, you have the sheeple for the broad masses. And then Springmeier has a more detailed structure as a pyramid. And that's too detailed to actually discuss family. And their name are the Pagers. And the question I have is, how did they fit into the paradigm? Well, at first, the answer is a bit complicated, and that does require some explanation. Now, Springmeier tells you about the 13 Illuminati bloodlines. The Pagers aren't in it. And I've done shows on this in the past, folks. So go into the archives, and you can check the 13 bloodlines. You have the Astors, the Bundys, the Collins, the DuPonts, the Freemans, the Kennedys. Yes, the Kennedys, folks. The Lees, the Onassis. Oh, think about it. Jackie Kennedy married the shipping magnate Onassis. There's the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, the Russells, the Van Dynes. Oh, didn't the Merovingians have influence up in that portion of Northern Europe? And then, of course, 13 is the Merovingian bloodline. Now, the Merovingians consider themselves special out of all 13 families. And why? Because they claim falsely that the blood of Christ actually is in their bloodline. You know, holy blood, holy grail. The whole false narrative that Jesus hooked up with Mary Magdalene and had offspring, and that's the holy grail. And they claim they need the blood of Christ and the seed of Satan. Remember, it doesn't matter what you believe about these statements I'm sharing with you here concerning their beliefs. What matters is understanding that they believe it. And by understanding that, you'll understand their motivation. And if you want to learn more on this, read Fritz Springmeier's book, Be Wise as Serpents. Now, there's a castle over there in southern France, Chateau des Amaurs, I think it is. It's known as the Castle of Kings. And you can get a lot of history like they're doing on the Curse of Oak Island as they go over there and follow the whole Templar trail. You can see the evidence of the Merovingian line and how they considered themselves to be rulers of the Illuminati above all others, including the Templars. Now, their name itself has a mythic origin, Merovich. That was the fabled leader dynasty. Now, the Merovingians consider themselves to be ancestors of the ancient Egyptian pharaohs. And you can follow those bumblebees and those cicadas and those beetles and those bugs all the way back to some of the relics from the Egyptians. Now, at one point in time, like I mentioned, Napoleon found himself fighting against the Merovingians, who are now the Bourbons in France, in the most unusual way. Oh, and by the way, the Pagers, where do they fit in? Well, they come out of the Merovingian line. So the Pagers were French royalty, descendants of Marie Antoinette, who fled France during the Revolution. And this bloodline of the Pagers goes all the way back to the Merovingians, who claim they go all the way back to the Egyptians. You see how this is all fitting together now? Now, Alex Christopher gives us more history in his book, The Ultimate Unseen Hand Behind a New World Order. That's another book by Alex Christopher. So what's the big deal about the Pager family? Well, when France, the country that founded the railroad, started their rail system back in the 1600s, I believe it was, guess what family started it? The Pager family. Now wind the clock ahead, okay? And this takes a lot of dots to connect here, okay? But wind the clock ahead to the development of the railroad in the United States of America. And guess what family you find behind the founding of the railroads in the United States of America? The Pager family. That's right, Paul, the Pager family. Not the Vanderbilts, but the Pagers.
Now, their name was hidden from public eye and public scrutiny through a series of trusts. But if you read Pandora's Box, you can connect all the dots. Alex Christopher did an excellent job doing that. Now, I could do show after show after show on this, folks, but there's just simply not enough time, and there's not enough time to cover all the crazy news. And if you don't hear me talk about it on here, it doesn't mean I didn't hear about it. I just can't fit it all in a show that goes about 2 hours. And remember, I don't have a huge staff here helping me. I have Brother Alex sending me some articles and occasionally Sister Kathy, but she's slowed down a lot. So you have to do your own research. And one thing you could do to help here, folks, is to spread the word. We've got a surge of listeners since I reactivated the Tribulation Now Facebook page that Sister Kathy used to operate. But we need to get the word out. So if you want to help me, spread the word, folks. So how do we tie this all into what's happening today? Dean, Ohio, and the rail collapse, or the Ohio train derailment. And, you know, now they're talking about sabotage. Some of the sensors that should have detected that flaming wheel on that one rail car appear to be deactivated. Now, a lot of people are immediately blaming the government and the railroad company for burning that all off. But Millie Weaver, who lives right down the road, Millie Weaver used to work for InfoWars, and she was the reporter who put out that bombshell story about all of the connections in the deep state. Then right after it, she got arrested. Well, listen to Millie Weaver. This is about a six-minute clip. Give the truth about the Ohio train derailment. I encourage you to go out and listen to the whole report by Millie Weaver. But here she's going to explain to you why they had to burn it off.
Hey, guys. Millie Weaver here. So I wanted to give you guys an update on the East Palestine, Ohio train derailment that recently happened. Now, I've been following this story very closely because I actually happen to live close to the area, about 35 miles or so out from where this derailment took place. So definitely it has been on my radar. So actually, my father, who happened to be a regional manager for a major railroad company, is a great person who has a lot of knowledge on trains and how rail companies happen to respond to these type of situations. So there was a lot of speculation going around on the internet, people being upset about how the situation was handled. And initially, I was really upset too, because I'm thinking, you know, why on earth in any situation would you ever need to burn the vinyl chloride into the atmosphere to then have it rain down acid rain on the people in the community? And really and truly, it's just, it's never a good situation in general. So what could have justified them making that call? So I reached out to my dad, and one of the first things I asked him about was there anything that these rail companies did that was not in proper protocol?
It's a very bad situation. The train is, it has a lot of nasty chemicals in it. It has some dry chemicals that will burn, and it's just not a good scenario all the way across the board.
When you looked at the manifest, did it look like they did everything as usual or by the book, or did you see anything that looked out of place?
Everything looked like they were on top of it. I mean, you know, you can't have any hazardous chemical cars right next to the locomotive or right next to the caboose, and you know, you can't have a whole lot of them together. You got to kind of mix and match with other kind of cars. I mean, there was a semolina car in there, which is a flour car, and there was plastic pellet cars in there. So they did what they needed to do by just kind of keeping everything separated. But when you have like a mix up like that, where they all pile on top of each other, I mean, it just creates a really bad scenario.
And so after he looked at the manifest, which, you know, initially we were concerned about how many hazardous train cars there were compared to the non-lethal or hazardous cars, because there are rules and regulations regarding spacing of these vehicles, these cars inside the train. So after he looked at the manifest, he said that overall it looks like they were following proper protocol, and you could see that they didn't have the hazardous ones up against the locomotive, locomotive or the caboose, and they did properly follow that protocol with having other tanks carrying non-lethal substances spaced between. In an article I was reading about how they actually, one of the tankers was malfunctioning, like the valve or something. And can you explain that? What does that mean when there's a valve malfunctioning?
Yeah, if you look at the call out on it, like it's a DOT 105, that's a 100-pound or 100 PSI tank, and it's rated. They're usually tested a little higher than that, but on a 105, DOT 105, the safety valves are 75 PSI. So what happens when you get a car in a derailment and the PRV, a pressure relief valve, doesn't work, is the pressure inside the tank is heated from the fire on the outside, and it heats the flammable gas on the inside to the point where the rail car will no longer hold the chemicals, and it explodes. And it's like a square mile radius that it just will flatten everything. And what they call that is a blevy. So that's probably the worst thing or scenario that you could have if you have a flammable tank car with a failed safety relief device. So if you have that and you have a flame next to it, you're building pressure, and you've got to do one or two things. You either got to get rid of that pressure or get rid of the flame, and it doesn't sound like they're able to put the flame down.
He said that whenever they do a burn, it is always a last resort. It was going to possibly blevy, which means the pressure would be so great inside that no longer would the walls be able to hold that pressure, and that's when you get a massive explosion. So when these train cars blevy, it can literally take out a square mile radius, like flatten it, all right? And it can send the tank flying through the air like a rocket, which could then land on someone or injure someone. So this could have been a situation where a massive explosion with a mile square radius, spewing flames, heat blasts, heat waves, as well as chemicals, right? Because that's what usually happens. So there are other videos out there on the internet of these blevies, just so you guys can actually see the magnitude of what that looks like. I'm going to play a little clip for you guys right here.
So there you have it. That's the reason they had to do this controlled burn, as they call it, blevy. Now, had they experienced that explosion, you talk about devastation, it could have been much worse. And that's because there was a faulty pressure relief valve. That DOT 105 valve defined at release at 75 PSI. It's like on your pressure cooker, folks. If something malfunctions on your pressure cooker, you have the pressure relief valve. Well, the valve was faulty. So not only did we have faulty sensors on the rail tracks, and not only did this thing flame for 25 minutes before the derailment, but we had a faulty pressure relief valve. So this gas, vinyl chloride's a gas, not a liquid. It's like liquefied propane, LPG. So Millie Weaver, thank you. You did a great update on the situation out in East Palestine, Ohio. She does a great interview with her dad. So there's a lot more detail there. Go out and listen to it. Now, I went to the Norfolk Southern webpage, and here's their report on this crisis in East Palestine, Ohio. And listen to the focus. I'm going to read it to you. Norfolk Southern is continuing to work with local, state, and federal leaders in the community affected by the derailment in East Palestine, Ohio, on February 3rd. Additionally, Norfolk Southern would like to update our customers on the status of railroad operations. Now, here's the real reason for the update. Both main lines were restored to service on February 7th, 4 days after the event. After our engineering team and contractors worked quickly to clear the site and lay down new infrastructure, Norfolk Southern continues to make progress in two key areas, addressing the backlog of traffic and getting power and crews back in cycle. As we continue to do so, customers will see a positive reflection of these efforts in the status of their shipments. So no mention of the fact that they had a faulty valve, no mention of the fact that they had a faulty sensor.
And they're not working on that. They're working to get the business back. So the reason the railroad got away with this isn't because they make political donations on both sides of the aisle. No, no. But rather because of their Illuminati origin by none other than the Pazier family, who married into the Vanderbilt and Astor families. The Astors were one of the 13 bloodlines, folks. And the Pastors came from the Merovingians. You see how all the pieces fit together? Now, you say this to the typical normie out there, the blue-pilled normie, the sheeple, and they'll think you're crazy. Now, it's easy enough to allow fear in when we hear all of this, but fear is a form of torment. And I promised you at the beginning of the show that we'd tie it all into the antidote for fear and torment. And that antidote, folks, is perfect love. Agape love. The love of God. Me loving God, but the love of God. You know, the Bible says in the first epistle of John, chapter 4, verse 18, there is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear, because fear hath torment. He that feareth is not made perfect in love. So what we're going to do here in the few remaining minutes is learn about perfect love, how to have it, and what happens when we don't have perfect love. Now, last week, Pastor Todd said in the opening of his message on relationships that perfect love, also known as agape love in Greek, would be easy if it wasn't for other people. Now, there are four types of loves, and there's a great book out there by C.S. Lewis called The Four Loves. I've done show on the four loves. Quickly, there's agape love. That's God's love and the love that the 1 Corinthians chapter 13 discourse is built upon. And then there's filial love or brotherly love. Then there's storge love, which is the love a parent has for their child. And finally, there's eros love, kind of like the love we have, Testament book written by Solomon. Anyways, folks, the love we're going to focus on today is the love God uses, his love, and the love that God changes you and me by. And that implies that God's love is transformational. Now remember, he first loved us so that we could love him. And we're not loved by God because God thinks we're lovable. No, we're lovable because we are loved by God. So remember this keystone truth, folks. God is love. And if you don't believe that, here's an assignment for you. Go out and read the first epistle of John, chapters 4 and 5. The Gospel of John, chapter 14 and 15, and then effectively known as the love chapters. And thank you, Pastor Todd, for sharing this with us last week. Now, these love chapters have amazing verses in them, like the one I'm going to share with you here. 1 John, chapter 4, verses 7 and 8 read, Beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God. And everyone that loveth is born of God and knoweth God. And he that loveth not knoweth not God. For God is love. So here's the fact. The fact is that God is love. And we see it first in the relationship between the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, which is eternal. Never wasn't and never will not be. So that's where the Arians were wrong. God the Father did not create God the Son. They coexisted for all of eternity. Now, Matthew chapter 3, verse 17 says, And lo, a voice from heaven came, saying, This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. So in that one passage, counted in the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 3, at the beginning of the ministry of Jesus, we see all persons of the Trinity there at once. The voice from heaven, that's God the Father, speaking concerning his beloved Son, Jesus, and then the descent of the dove. So there you have it, God's perfect love. Now, to love well, as God loves, other-centered, and that's the key here. When you become self-centered, it's another kind of love. Maybe it's filial, maybe it's storge, or perhaps it's eros, but it's not agape. So if you want to love properly, and if you want to cast out fear and torment, you must have agape love. So how do you do that? Well, first of all, you have to recognize that God loves you. And if you disagree with this, and if you're saying, well, I don't know about that, Bro Ken, I really don't know if God loves me, read 1 John chapter 4, verse 9. In this was manifested the love of God towards us, because that God sent his only begotten Son into the world that we might live through him. Now, this word begotten here is where the Arians got into their false theology concerning the creation of Jesus. Begotten does not mean created, and it's been changed in a lot of the modern translations, folks. That's a topic for another day. Still don't believe that God loves you? Well, then read the classic of all verses, John 3, verse 16. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. There's that begotten again. That doesn't mean created. That whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have eternal, everlasting life. So when we recognize that God's love is perfect, we then become capable of healing in broken relationships. Now, the perfect demonstration of his perfect love is accounted to us over in John chapter 15, verses 12 through 13, where Jesus says to his apostles, "This is my commandment, that ye love one another as I have loved you. Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends." And that was what Jesus was preparing to do. The perfect lamb, blemish free, was prepared to lay down his life to bear the sins of you and me. And that's perfect agape love. And that's why perfect love casts out fear. Now, no one else can love us like God loves us. And when we realize that, when we realize that God loves us to that degree, that he would lay down his very life to save us, then that love becomes other-centered in our lives. But when it isn't, and when we don't realize that, it's selfish, protective, self-centered, and then relationships break. In other words, selfishness breaks agape love. But praise the Lord, God loves us unconditionally, and he shows us the way. So if you want to experience God's love, and if you want to be free from fear and torment, you got to love back as God loves. First, you got to love God with all your heart, your mind, and your soul. And then you've got to love others as you love yourself. One way to think about it, folks, and Pastor Todd did a good job illustrating this last Sunday in church. Think about an outlet on your wall. Your finger in the outlet and get shocked. I've done it before. Not really sticking my finger in, but kind of in a dark room, put my finger between the prongs on the plug and then sticking the prong into the outlet. Don't do that. You'll get shocked. There's a potential energy in there. When you put the plug in, it gets activated. And that's the same thing we have to do. We have to plug into the love of God. First, by loving God after we realize that he loves us, and then using it to love others in a selfless way. Jesus said in John chapter 14, verse 23, Jesus answered and said unto him, "If a man love me, he will keep my words, and my Father will love him, and we will come unto him and make our abode with him." And then in chapter 15, verses 9 and 10, Jesus continues and says, "As the Father hath loved me, so I have loved you. Continue ye in my love. If ye keep my commandments, ye shall abide in my love, even as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love." So, folks, I'm going to wrap this up by saying, just as God loves you, can love others. 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 4 begins that entire teaching on agape love with this. And in the King James, St. Paul uses the word charity to differentiate love, agape love, from the other loves. So agape suffereth long and is kind. In other words, agape love is patient. Now, Pastor Todd did the same thing I did. I read right over that. I thought the meat was later in the chapter. But praise the Lord, the key is right there. God's love is patient. So God's potential love patiently awaits you plugging in to his divine circuit. So what is patience? Well, Pastor Todd said, patience is loving another as they go in another direction or at another pace than you're at. Patience is the buffer of agape love. The love of God is patient, folks, patiently waiting for a response. So if you don't know God's love, it's there. Just plug into the Holy Spirit circle. Complete the circuit. And imagine what this reality would be if we all lived in this perfect, other-centered love. And like that quote I read from Terry, you know, perfect love. Let me just go get the quote. Give me 1 second here. I have it right over here on the other desk. I'm going to read it for you. And here it is. When the power of love overcomes the love of power, the world will know peace. And that was from none other than Jimi Hendrix, folks. And that's truth. Now, in the words of Winston Churchill, remember, folks, as you go out this week, stand in this love of God and make your focus other person. And in his words, never give in, never, no, never.
Never give in. Never give in. Never, never, never. In nothing, great or small, large or petty, never give in except to convictions of honor and good sense. Never yield to force. Never yield to the apparently overwhelming might of the enemy.
And remember, that same spirit that rose Jesus from the grave has been given to us because God loves us, because God wants us in relationship with him. So let's raise our hands with Jeremy Camp and praise the Lord.
We're living in a very defining time in our generation, where fear is creeping in and the uncertainty of the unknown is everywhere.
I can see what is raging at my feet. I can feel the breath of those surrounding me. I can hear the sound of nations rising up. We will not be overtaken. We will not be overcome. I can walk.
There's an urgency like never before in my heart to proclaim the good news of Jesus Christ, to show a world that looks like there is no hope that in Jesus alone you will find that hope and peace, to stand up in the midst of adversity and tribulation, and to show the unconditional love of our Savior while not shying away from speaking the truth of God's Word. Cry out for change in our world, but many times we are left asking, how can I make a difference? What do I do next? The truth is, we can do nothing. In our own strength and our own power, we will fail. But Jesus himself said to the disciples, I leave with you my spirit. In Romans 8:11 it says, if the spirit of him who raised Jesus from the dead dwells in you, will also give life to your mortal bodies through his spirit who dwells in you. Let's step out in his power. Let's proclaim the name of Jesus in boldness and love. And when the attacks come from all sides, walk in the understanding that greater is he that is in us than he that is in the world, because the enemy has been defeated and his victory is in Jesus. Oh,